Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Federalism and Separation of Powers Practice Group, was recorded on Friday, February 2, 2018, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federal Society members.
Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group telephone conference call, as today we discuss and give an update on the release of the Nunez Memorandum. My name is Dean Royer, Vice President, Director of Practice Groups here at the Federal Society, also General Counsel. As always, all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. And always, as always, the call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future and will likely be transcribed to make it more searchable on the Internet. We're very pleased to welcome return guest, often with us on Teleform, David B. Rifkin. He's a constitutional lawyer and litigator, a former Department of Justice and White House counsel official, and, of course, a frequent contributor to the Wall Street Journal and other publications as well. He's going to give us some opening remarks, including background of about 15 or 20 minutes, but as always, we'll be looking to the audience for questions, so please have those in mind for when we get to that portion of the program. With that, Mr. David Rifkin, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much. I may go a little less than 15 minutes, but let's see how long it takes. So I presume everybody on this call has read the memo by now. What I would say, looking at it entirely on the merits, in terms of what the various points being made and forgetting some challenges which we can tackle a bit later as to the motivations of the people involved, et cetera, et cetera. The facts are disquieting. They certainly suggest that there was an incomplete, at best an incomplete, and not a fulsome disclosure to the FISC, Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, in the context of the application. Sometimes people call it a warrant. Actually, the technical term is an order for a FISC order on Mr. Page. Such application had been filed on October 21, 2016. I would say several things here. As we all know, the whole FISA process has been challenged from time to time, certainly every time FISA is reauthorized, but done in the context of a Patriot Act reauthorization as well by civil libertarians. So I would say this is something that requires as much transparency as is possible, and I can think of no good circumstances, none at all, but driven by statute or regulation for the National Security Division of DOJ and the FBI, who filed that application not to disclose all of the information to the FISC judge. Now, what do we know just parsing what's in this memo? So the initial application was filed. There was no disclosure that Mr. Steele was working for Glenn Simpson, and Glenn Simpson was working for Mr. Mark Elias at Perkins Coie on behalf of the DNC and the Hillary Clinton campaign. That is absolutely clear. There's a little bit of an anodyne description in Section 1B of this memo, which says that the application notes that Steele was working for a named U.S. person. My guess would be that they mentioned that he was working for Mark Elias at Perkins Coie, which is a respected law firm. But it certainly did not give a full flavor of what's going on to a FISC judge. And I'm repeating myself when I say I can think of no good reason for incomplete disclosure. Then we get into the business about how consequential this information was, and information in the dossier, and therefore information about the context for this dossier. Well, the memo mentions that there's probably, I guess, a classified testimony of it. It's the very end of a memo by then Deputy Director McCabe that talks about the fact that, but for the this dossier, that this FISC order would not have been sought or obtained. So whatever else was on the table, if you sort of use the traditional but-for test, this dossier was very, very consequential. And then you have several other disquieting points, aside from the fact that you did not mention the information, full disclosure about who Mr. Steele was and what he was working for. It appears, and frankly, I think it's new information, that Mr. Steele was an FBI informant who was suspended and terminated for what FBI considers to be a very serious breach of trust. Not just an authorized disclosure about it, but the fact that he lied to the FBI about it. And I understand that not all FBI informants are necessarily people of sterling character, but by and large, you have to believe that your informant, at least whatever he or she did in prior life, is telling you the truth. So the fact that that information was not disclosed is troubling. Now, let's give the folks involved the benefit of the doubt. They did not become aware of this information until sometime after October 21, by the end of October. But this fiscal order, as is required by Section 1805, which was obtained, requires reauthorization every 90 days, certainly, and it appears that it's been reauthorized several times. So by the time you get to the first reauthorization, the FBI and DOJ knew it. Not only Mr. Steele was working, which we already did it as of October 21, was working for Hillary Clinton campaign, but knew that he lied to the FBI and was terminated as an FBI source. That information certainly would have been, in my opinion, should have necessarily been brought to the attention of Fisk, in which case I very much doubt that the order would have been reauthorized. One other sort of factual point here. I'm troubled not only, and I think the facts are troubling, not only as to how the order was obtained, was applied for and obtained, but the timing. There's nothing formal about it in the U.S. Attorney's Manual, but I know that there is a very important rule that, an unwritten rule, but nevertheless DOJ follows. They try to avoid as much as possible taking any investigative and other actions with respect to political campaigns for very obvious reasons, because they tend to leak and they do impact political campaigns and electoral contests, which is at the very heart of our democracy. So the question becomes this: why or why was this warrant sought on October 21, slightly over 2 weeks before the November elections? FBI knew about Mr. Page and his involvement. In fact, he's working for Merrill Lynch. He lived in Moscow for a time and was involved with Russian companies, which is all entirely legal. But if they felt otherwise, they had 2013 and 2014 and 2015 to obtain a fisc order against them, or could have waited until after the November elections. So to me, one of the key questions that needs to be answered is not only the circumstances in which this application was filed and order obtained, but why did it happen on October 21 versus a bit later period of time. To mention one other thing, look, I'm not prepared to say that we know everything, but the facts are sufficiently troubling. They need to be investigated. They should not be swept under the rug. Investigation should focus not only, and not just an IG investigation. IG investigations are a useful tool, but they're not the same as criminal investigations. In my opinion, this matter, given what's at stake, has to be investigated very thoroughly, involving the circumstances relating to this particular application, but also broader context, because it's certainly inferentially the case that this particular application and the inadequate disclosure to Fisk took place in the context of rampant leaks to the media, which I suspect most of the folks in this phone call would not think is necessarily such a bad idea, but it is a fact. Blatant unmasking undertaken not by people in this particular lane, the ones that secured the Fisk order, but certainly senior national security officials of the previous administration, including folks like Director Brennan and Director Clapper and National Security Advisor Rice. So you kind of put it all together, and it is a very, very disturbing picture where this particular exercise, which is troubling in its own right, may be a part of a broader pattern here. The last thing I would say, and I find it quite disturbing, that so far in the days leading to this, the attention has not been on the merits. I'm happy to discuss the merits, but it all been on what I consider, you know, process issues, impugning the motives of the people who released it, arguing that this is unprecedented, breaks, you know, exposes sources and methods and hurts the reputation of FBI. Just to say briefly two things. First of all, it absolutely doesn't matter what the motivations of people might have been who drove the release of his memo at this time. They could have been good, they could have been bad. I think they're perfectly appropriate. But if you think otherwise, that gives you no reason to sweep things under the rug, given the disturbing nature of the facts. Second, the notion that this document reveals any sources and methods is laughable. It doesn't. And moreover, we all know that whenever important public policy issues are discussed, be it the Iran-Contra, be it the 9/11, hundreds of pages worth of enormously sensitive classified information, including presidential daily brief, CIA's national intelligence assessments and estimates, NIEs, et cetera, get released. And nobody says that that's a bad thing because, you know, there are instances where the importance of a public disclosure in a debate and reform are so paramount. And as to hurting the reputation of the FBI, again, if you look at any of the exercises, that two of which I mentioned, but many other exercises, Congress, and if it's done by an outside commission, frequently criticize the agencies involved for various things ranging from, you know, incompetence to bad faith and even unlawful conduct. So, you know, the notion that the critics are saying that this is somehow a dastardly plot against our national security institutions, to me, just rings so hollow given, you know, 9/11 and exercise and Iran-Contra exercise aside, and just reminding me, maybe I'm the oldest person on this call, the Pike and Church Committee hearings, where CIA was massively taken to task with enormous level of disclosure of classified information for various things they've done during the Cold War, and strenuously criticized. I don't remember anybody saying at the time that that was somehow unpatriotic. Anyway, I'm going to stop here and see if we can have some dialogue going.
Yeah, well, we've got well over 250 people on the phone, so I expect quite a few questions. So let's open the floor right away. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question for our guest, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Once again, if you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. As people begin to queue up, let me ask the first question, if I could. And that is, you know, if this request, the FISA warrant, was reissued several times, requested by so many different people, what does that say about the legitimacy of the process? If so many people were involved in requesting this, and if it was approved and reapproved and extended, doesn't that support the argument that it was a legitimate request from the outset?
I'm afraid, Dean, that the reverse is true. And look, it pains me to say this. I'm a great supporter of national security related investigative techniques and methods. I happen to think that FISA provides some indispensable tools that we need to guard our national security in always, particularly in very dangerous times we live now. The civil libertarians have always been critical of FISA, arguing that the ex parte nature of the application, various other factors, just, you know, makes, in fact, FISC a rubber stamp. As I said, I'm talking about admitting some mistakes on my part. I've actually written quite a bit against this notion. My fear is that actually both things are not highly scrutinized, particularly in the it's a guess on my part. In the reauthorization mode, you basically have some very busy national security officials. The statute requires, you know, sort of free designated officials to review this. The Attorney General, Deputy Attorney General, the head of a National Security Division are all very, and I'm not saying that anything wrong, they're all very busy people with hundreds of things to do every day, and I suspect they highly rely on the probity of, you know, two or three people who sort of generated the application and worked on it. And I very much doubt if it was brought, for example, to the attention of people who secured their authorization that Mr. Steele was terminated by FBI for lying sometime after the original application was filed. I would be very surprised if this fact was flagged for whoever was reviewing it, that it would not have been wait a minute, let's stop. And again, you have to flag things. I mean, having worked myself for very busy people in the White House Counsel's office and DOJ, can't just give them, even if it's written somewhere, a 100-page application, and expect them to ferret it out. You got to stop and say, hey, boss, I want to bring this one inconvenient truth to your attention. So I'm afraid that this system is not as resilient to misuse as some of us might have believed, and that is troubling.
And I think it'd be unlikely for the reviewing officials to know to ask the right question in a pointed way about the a weakness. But with that, we've got several people. Go ahead.
But yes,
please.
Because it's not natural. You know, when I worked for, you know, White House Counsel, Seaborn Gray, who was a dear friend and a mentor, he trusted me. I worked for many years. It would not occur to him to say, David, are you, when you're asking me to do something, are you on the up and up? I mean, it's not the normal question you ask of your trusted subordinates.
Very good. Once again, if you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We've got several people in the queue. With that, let's take our first question of the day.
Yes, good afternoon. This is Leo Dombrowski, Chicago Chapter. Two questions. One, does the DOJ have an obligation to go back to the FISA court and disclose what it should have disclosed earlier? And two, does the FISA court have any authority to sanction or question or investigate those who submitted the applications if the FISA court thinks that it was diluted?
The short answer, it's an excellent question. The short answer is yes and yes. To elaborate, I think DOJ and the FBI have a continuing obligation to disclose newly acquired information, and to the extent that not even that newly acquired in the sense that it's clear to the people who are in charge now. Actually, interesting historical footnote in terms of what FISA or FISC, Foreign Surveillance Court, has done. There have been a number of instances which are detailed in a pretty voluminous report, the 9/11 report that dealt with, among other things, the so-called wall. You may remember before the post 9/11 reforms, there is a wall of separation between the counterintelligence side and the criminal investigation side. And there were some instances where FISC was apparently not told the full truth about the precise reason for initiating what appeared to be a counterintelligence investigation that may have been done indirectly to aid a criminal investigation where they could not get the normal Title III warrant, and FISC reacted very negatively to it, chastising the people involved, and if my memory serves me right, banning them from ever appearing before FISC. Because again, the system relies to a tremendous degree on the trust and confidence that everybody is playing by the rules, because it's not like FISC is undertaking or is capable of undertaking a separate investigation. So we are talking about instances where there have been some problems in the past. There have been corrective actions taken. Some individuals were, you know, terminated or at least not allowed to come before FISC, and it made FISC most unhappy, and as I, again, direct you to the 9/11 Commission report. But, again, what's troubling to me here, and I would say any kind of misleading applications are bad, but this appears to be at least is something that's not driven by excessive zeal to, you know, engage in law enforcement and catch some bad guys. But if it's, as it appears to be, driven by political motivations, it is enormously troubling. I would put it in the highest level of misconduct that threatens the legitimacy of this very vital tool and just cannot be countenanced.
So this is Dean Reuter again. Once again, if you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. And let me ask a question that I think some of the skeptics might want to hear your response to, and that's, if this is so consequential, if it does rise to such a level of bad behavior, there are, I suppose, two courses. One is to disclose it and air it out. But I think the skeptics might say the better course here would be to make a corrective action privately and to do otherwise, that is to air it out, to go public with this, damages people's understanding understanding of the FISA process. It damages their faith in the process, I would say, not their understanding. It probably improves their understanding, but it damages their faith in that, and then has national security implications.
Well, let's say a couple of things. First of all, let's have faith in the sound judgment of American people and sound judgment of elected representatives. I mean, the American people and members of Congress are not children. I think they can stand the truth. There's no reason to not to apply the best disinfectant, which is publicity. But I would also say, Dean, if you look at this historically, every time there was a serious concern about major failures, either in the form of misconduct by law enforcement and intelligence agencies or in the form of intelligence failures, the corrective always involved public airing of those things. It never just involved some private actions taken. And by the way, I mean, another thing that is sort of interesting to put on the table here, we do know that a number of people have been, again, how do we know, based upon media reporting, have been reassigned in ways that is not exactly indicative of them being lauded, to just name a few. So you have former Deputy Director McCabe, who, again, according to the media reporting, instead of being allowed to basically continue until March, was told by the Director A that he would move him to some other less consequential position in the FBI immediately, causing Deputy Director McCabe to basically go on vacation until March. You had a general counsel whose name is Baker to be reassigned lesser position. Again, nobody has been criminally prosecuted thus far, but these types of reassignments do not don't just occur if everything is fine. So yes, there has to be some house cleaning, but it cannot be a substitute for a public airing of these issues. And look, if effects turn out to be otherwise, that's useful too. But I would not want to sweep it under the rug. That would be worse. That's kind of a cure that's worse than a disease.
Let's check in with another caller.
Hi, David. This is Kurt Levy with Committee for Justice. Thanks for briefing us, I joined the call in the middle, so please forgive me if you've addressed any of these issues. But you just mentioned criminal prosecution of some of the people involved. Assuming that it would be appropriate to appoint a special prosecutor here, who do you think would be the appropriate person? Would it be Sessions, given that he recused himself from the Russia scandal, the alleged Russian collusion? But that doesn't mean he recused himself from, you know, all wrongdoing connected to it. Or would it be the DAG? And then two, would it be more appropriate to find a new someone new, you know, to have a parallel investigation to Mueller, or just to give that responsibility to Mueller? Or I guess at the other end of the spectrum, I don't expect Mueller to be fired given this, you know, just given the political considerations, but could you make a legal argument that, through some, discredited branch, that the Mueller probe should end?
Well, several things. Let me tackle the last one first. I understand the fruit of a poisonous tree argument. But I certainly am not prepared to say that this demonstrates any kind of, not prepared to say, I'm prepared to say affirmatively, it doesn't manifest any misconduct on the part of Special Counsel Mueller, anybody who's working for him right now, since he dismissed Peter Sorsak and Lisa Page. So I think that frankly is sort of another misdirection by the critics who are sort of saying this is an effort to vitiate the Mueller investigation. I don't think it is really that at all. That's point number one. As to what should be done, I think it should be thoroughly investigated. I think it should be investigated beyond the IG exercise. And the right person to investigate this, I think I'm not a big fan of special counsels, again, having written about this, so I have to eat my words a bit. But I think probably either a special counsel or somebody brought from the outside, even if technically his title is not the special counsel, should drive this. I would not give it to Mueller, since it's really of some sense of very different, a bit related, but very different investigation. He's got enough on his plate. I would say whoever is investigating it should be somebody, you know, a former U.S. attorney from way back who has absolutely no relationships with the current senior career people at DOJ, FBI, because it's, again, it's not only has to be fair and thorough, but it has to have an appearance of fairness. So I would not bring somebody who just retired, you know, a couple of years ago. As to who should appoint that person, look, I've not seen obviously the precise parameters of the recusal letter that was executed for the Attorney General. So I don't really know whether or not it's in it's on his on his page, so to speak. If he is not recused from taking this action, then he would be the right person. If Rosenstein, if he is recused because of a breadth of recusal determination, then Rosenstein should do it, or it could be done by the Associate Attorney General, who is Rachel Brand, if I'm not mistaken. But, I mean, that to me is not a particularly important question. The important question is that it should be fairly investigated, and it should be done by somebody who is known for probity, but also, as I said, not a recent retiree from either the FBI or DOJ. And again, a former U.S. attorney, somebody who's been gone for, you know, 10 or 15 years, would be a good bet, in my opinion.
Another very quick question. You had said that there's absolutely nothing plausibly in that memo that would, you know, raise national security concerns, you know, if disclosed. Why do you think the Justice Department, or the FBI, I should say, made that argument, given that they knew the memo was going to eventually come out and would show that to be wrong?
Well, gosh, kind of put it gently, two things. First of all, it's very clear that FBI and DOJ did not want this to come out, and done all they could. And the first thing, which also troubling, that it took a year to get at the information that caused HPSI, House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence, to take this action. That, and if I'm not mistaken, they had to issue a threat of holding the FBI director in contempt, and probably the DAG as well. That's pretty unusual. So they've been resisting this mightily. And again, it's not a good sign. I'm not prepared to say that that disposes of everything, but it's not a good sign. Typically, human nature being what it is, you don't try to hide something unless you find it painful and embarrassing. Now, as to why they said that it would compromise sources and methods, when they know that once anybody who has any experience in national security reads this memo, you know, people say stupid stuff hoping that, you know, it would not happen, that they would be able to stifle the release. Look, we know that they went to trouble of going to Paul Ryan to try to get him to, you know, in fact, override the judgment of the of a HPSI chairman, Congressman Nunes. So they just did their best to stop it, and they try to throw as many arguments. Here, look, the argument is going to embarrass us. By itself, it's kind of embarrassing, no pun intended. So waving the national security shirt is kind of useful. But as I said, it's a joke. I mean, if you look at the extent to which things have been released very, very recently about far more sensitive matters, I don't see anything here, nothing, and the compromise is any sources and methods. Could be wrong, I suppose. I'm a lawyer, not a you know, intelligence professional, but I just don't see it.
Several Thanks, questions David. Pending, so let's keep moving forward.
Hi, my name is Don Perdue. I'm a lawyer in practice in D.C. I have two related questions. The first is, does Carter Page have a viable action under Section 93? And then the second question is, what statute was Page alleged to have violated that justified wiretapping him, and what was the evidence that he violated, the probable cause that he violated that statute. I've never been able to find that in any of the news reports. Thanks.
Well, sure. The first question is, I don't know. It just depends on what comes out in the investigation. I don't think he has an ability to mount a legal challenge now. As to the second question, I'm actually looking at the section. It's section 1805. 50 U.S.C. that, and just read very briefly the pertinent language. So you basically apply asking Fisk to make a finding, and the standard is, and it's been held to be in the context of a proper application for Fourth Amendment compliant, that on the basis of a fact submitted by the applicant, and we know who the applicant here is, there's probable cause to believe that Mr. Page, in this case, is an agent of a foreign power. And there are some other caveats about the fact that it cannot be solely on the basis of activities protected by the First Amendment, so et cetera, et cetera. So that's how the process works. And as I said, this is a process that's very, very vital to our national security. Has drawn criticisms in the past, and there have been people who wanted greater transparency, who talk about having a ombudsman sort of be a fly on the wall opposing various requests made of Fisk. Again, I've always criticized that, thinking that it would impair the efficiency too much. But this is very troubling, very troubling. And I tell you, if it turns out, as I suspect it will, that serious misconduct occurred, my anger would be in large part not just because of the offense itself, but because of a harm that the people who had done that have caused to the legitimacy of this type of an effort. They're just inexcusable, and they are the ones who truly are damaging the reputation of the institutions and the process, not the people who are suggesting that the investigation is needed. That's kind of as backwards, if I may.
We've got six or seven questions pending, so let's continue to roll through them as we may. Go right ahead, caller.
This is David Hubert in Atlanta. Does the last FISA judge have the ability to vitiate the warrant, and can he sanction the parties that appeared before him?
Well, I mean, Fisk, yes, of course. I like to call it an order, but anyway, call it a warrant. Yes, a warrant can be withdrawn, I believe, if a Fisk judge is aware that it was improperly obtained. As I mentioned earlier in the call, based upon examples cited in the 9/11 Commission report, there have been reprimands and various other things that Fisk has imposed on individuals who misled it in the context of very same types of applications. Now, if you ask me more esoteric question, can he actually punish somebody? Does a Fisk judge have contempt power? Look, there are Article III judges at the trial level. There are district court judges at the appellate chamber of Fisk. There are appellate judges. I mean, federal judges do have formidable contempt powers. I honestly don't know, though, if it would work, how it would work here, because they're not functioning as district court judges. They're wearing a different hat. But it's an interesting question. I don't know if it ever occurred, if sanctions were ever imposed beyond, chastisement and sort of bureaucratic humiliation and institutional demotions. But I can tell you, if investigation shows that it was not just sort of a sloppy, but it was deliberate omissions, there is certainly an opportunity to prosecute an individual involved using the perjury as a cause of action, or at the very least, failure to provide accurate information to a government, which is 18 U.C. 1001.
Thank you.
Once again, if you have a call or question, rather, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Take another question now.
Hi, David. This is Ken Cuccinelli. Thanks for your rundown.
Thanks, Ken.
It's good to hear from you. So one of the things in the memo at the very bottom of the first page lapping onto the second, and we've had a little discussion here about it, is the stated expectation by Congressman Nunes that information that may have been helpful to Page's side of the consideration of the FISC as to whether or not to grant or reject the requested warrant was not shared. And he seems surprised by that. And now I've at least filed motion in the FISC, but I haven't been on the government side. My impression, and I'm happy to be corrected or validated as you see fit, is that I'll call them prosecutors, but the prosecutors who go into this process do not feel obligated to share everything with a judge, in much the same way a prosecutor in a fairly traditional criminal case would not feel obligated to share information that is anything other than supportive of his or her request for a warrant. Is that somehow different in the FISC than it is in ordinary criminal process? And I would just note for everybody else on the call that what I view as the big difference is that in an ordinary criminal case, at some point, the defendant gets to address these questions, but not in the FISC. So
again,
I'm curious your
you and I in wild agreement. Let me explain a little bit, and apologize if I'm technical for the non-lawyers here. So what Ken is referring to, of course, there's Brady obligation under a famous Supreme Court case to provide exculpatory evidence. In the context of criminal prosecution, sometimes it doesn't work that well, but prosecutors get in trouble for that, and justifiably so. And Ken is absolutely right that despite all the rigors and unpleasantness to the accused of a criminal process, in the criminal process, they do have an opportunity to get through Brady in discovery to get at the truth and be able to be exonerated. That is not the case with FISC. I would also say that in my opinion, though, I certainly wouldn't use the Brady standard. Well, again, it's an elegant intellectual question, since the information obtained through FISC-granted orders can actually be used for criminal prosecution. I mean, maybe one can infer some kind of a Brady obligation at that stage, but 99% of the time it doesn't get so used. But I would say this, both to maintain the legitimacy of this process and to reassure the American people that everything is proper, I would expect a higher level of compliance with fullest disclosure requirement, Ken, in this context. Why? Well, you have an adversarial context in the criminal prosecution. You're prosecuting somebody, you're, you know, hardworking AUSA, you think you got a bad guy in your sights, and you kind of balance your obligations under Brady to being able to win, because you think there's a bad guy, he's a bank robber, he's a Ponzi schemer, he's a rapist, he's this, he's that. It's nothing like this here. All you're doing here, basically, is you're trying to get information in the context of telling FISC everything you know. There's nobody you're sparring with. Your only interlocutor is FISC itself. So I would say, if anything, more disclosure is needed here. So the fact that it hasn't occurred, that it, at best it was incomplete, is more troubling to me than less than fulsome compliance with Brady requirements. Does that make sense?
Oh, it absolutely does, and I would agree. We are in vehement agreement, but I what struck me is, first of all, I don't assume that these prosecutors do turn everything over to FISC, and I never have. But it's surprising to me that the congressman, the head of the Intelligence Committee, seems to presume that happens, and he's just wrong about that. And he's the head of the House Intelligence Committee. It harkens back to when Snowden's revelations came out, Congressman Sensenbrenner, who played such a significant role in drafting that part of the Patriot Act, was shocked to learn the extensiveness of the snooping on all of us, and including on this call, that our government was doing for years and years and years, gathering up all of our cell phone data, everything except the words we were saying to each other. And the guy who wrote the law was shocked to learn that. And so here we again have a congressman who seems surprised that that there isn't more disclosure that they never have required when they've reauthorized FISA and the FIST. I mean,
right.
It screams out for reform, screams out for it.
Yeah, well, I agree with you. Well, you're obviously talking about the metadata collection under Section 215 of the Patriot Act. These are very delicate matters, which is why I am pretty mad, not just at the sort of a political partisanship, but what it would lead to. Because you're right, if there is an investigation, I'm pretty certain there will be one, and it turns out that, hey, look, our defense is, yeah, we didn't provide all the information to FISC. We hid the information that would have caused them not to authorize this order. But we do it over time. I mean, that's a hell of a poor defense. I mean, that is very unfortunate. It's sort of saying, you know, in response to perjury allegation, well, it's nothing unusual. I perjure myself all the time. So I hope it's not the case. And again, look, their nuances matter. The question is, you know, did you not disclose some small tidbits, some minor detail, or did you not disclose something that was highly probative? To me, the fact that he was working for DNC and Hillary Clinton's campaign is enormously consequential. But back to the point of the fact that during the subsequent application or reauthorization, they never told FISC apparently that he was terminated. Again, terminated. We're talking about somebody who's an informant, for God's sake. It's a pretty low bar. Because informants often have done bad things in their previous careers, but at the very least, FBI or police department, any law enforcement agency would expect them to be straight with them now. Otherwise, what good are they? So that is just horrible failure, in my opinion.
Yeah. Thanks, David.
Sure.
Once again, if you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We've got about 20 minutes left. Quite a few questions lined up, but we'll get to as many as possible. Go right ahead, caller.
Hi, my name is David from Berkeley, California. And I wonder if you have thought about the possible connection between what's come out in this report and the widespread unmaskings that took place in the last days of the Obama administration.
I have. In fact, I mentioned earlier, perhaps I was a little overly generic, that one of the interesting questions here is whether or not this flawed application process was part of a broader effort that included unmasking and leaks, unmasking, you know, both internally, which of course is also quite regulated there, you know, specific statutory criteria for when unmasking is appropriate. But
David, it's yep. Dean. I wonder if you could, for our audience benefit, tell us what unmasking is.
Sure. Unmasking refers to the process where you are disclosing two things. Disclosing the it works in two ways. First of all, disclosing the identity of a person whose phone call or an email has been intercepted. The general rule is that you're not supposed to disclose, and the people who see it, of course, are, you know, fairly junior career people with absolutely no policy access or political access to grind. So if Dean Reuter, for example, if you're being surveilled, your name would not be disclosed to anybody else in the government absent a determination that has to be done in good faith, that knowing who you are is essential to understanding the content, to put in proper context the content of a conversation. And that happens rarely, and I remember vividly some folks being criticized in the past doing confirmation hearings because they made, you know, half a dozen unmasking requests. I'm particularly thinking about John Bolton's confirmation, where he was not confirmed for the U.S. Ambassador of the United Nations, because when he was Undersecretary of State, he asked for, I think, fewer than half a dozen occasions to disclose the names of people who wiretapped to put the conversations in context. The second context, the second part of unmasking would be disclosing the identity of another person who is involved in this conversation. Because remember, Dean, you never talk to yourself unless you're, I suppose, mentally ill. So there's always a second party to a conversation, and that party is being captured incidentally to the collection driven by you, if you are the target of surveillance. So disclosing both the identities of either the person who's being surveilled or the name of the person whom that target spoke, and disclosing then the content of a conversation by the other side, these are all violate unmasking. One thing I would say, I don't have a precise numbers, but I've seen newspaper stories indicating that literally dozens of unmasking requests have been made in the final months and weeks of the 2016 presidential campaign, which is highly troubling. If I were investigating this, my question would be why are you doing this? And second of all, typically unmasking is being sought by, let's say, mid-level or senior analysts who are trying to come up with some analysis, some report on what's really going on. And they would say to more junior people, look, I'm the world's greatest expert on Persia, so I kind of want to know which person was talking to Ahmadinejad on the U.S. side. Gives me some extra analytical umph. But why a national security advisor who is not an intelligence analyst and does not write reports and is sort of a big picture person, why would a national security advisor be involved in unmasking people? I frankly cannot think of very good reasons.
Looks like we've got three questions pending, so let's continue on our way.
Hi, David. Building off of the last question a little bit, the memo does not tell us exactly who the FBI surveilled with its now authorized surveillance. So, for example, was the surveillance limited to Carter Page, or did it extend to President Trump, his family, his campaign team, and then later his transition team? And are we likely to ever find that out? Because if they got to surveil the entire apparatus of the campaign solely on the basis of Carter Page in this dossier, that would truly be an enormity.
Well, no. Okay, good question. To clarify, I probably should have done it by now. The way things work, if you are the target, okay, they surveil you, and they surveil various communication devices you use. But inevitably, it captures your conversations with everybody, your family members, your colleagues, and if you're involved in the campaign, campaign officials. And it's highly predictable that that would happen, which is, I don't think that they sought to obtain an independent targeting order on, you know, President Trump and various other people, but they certainly knew that by surveilling Carter Page, they would obtain a wealth of conversations involving other campaign officials. And that's what gives me considerable pause, particularly given the date which this application was sought. So, I mean, look, President Trump was much maligned and criticized for saying, you know, they wiretapped the tower. As a technical matter, he is wrong. But as a practical matter, he is not, because if you have FISA orders and a couple of people like Carter Page, like Papadopoulos, you pretty much capture everybody they talk to. And then if you read all this, and then if you leak a bunch of things, it produces basically the same results. Does that make sense?
It does. Thank you. One more question, and I defer to you and Ken on practices of prosecutors, but it also seems to me every FISA court is a federal court, and every federal court has a bar, which the lawyers appearing before that court have to be a member to. And every federal court in the country has adopted Model Rule 3.3, absolute candor toward the tribunal. And that rule covers not just positive misrepresentations, but omissions of material facts. And it even explains that that duty extends to the end of the proceeding, and that if you come into information that the court should have to fill out the picture, that you have a duty to do that. And so might any of these applicants or affiants be subject to some sort of disbarment as a result of this?
Well, two things. Again, I don't frankly know. It's been a long time since I'm in the government. I don't know if there is a – I doubt very much there's a, quote, bar here, because to explain, this is a highly classified process, and the people who can apply to FISC, and they have to run it for the gauntlet of the National Security Division of the Justice Department, there's a very small number of people. What I said before, and the 9/11 Commission report describes it, then FISC judges felt that somebody was lying to them, they would basically say, we never want to see this person. I don't know if it's not really a formal debarment in a sense where you send some complaint to the person, bar association, if you're from Maryland or Virginia or whatever. But look, I agree with you. I think, and by the way, it's an interesting question. If I were a FISC judge who approved this application and I'm reading all this stuff now, I would be pretty hopping mad. And I may say, well, all right, well, let me see which way it unfolds. But I would want to kick the tires and lose myself, because you're right. They have absolute obligation to for full disclosure to the court. And as you heard my exchange with Ken, I think this obligation actually is higher in the FISA context, and particularly high if you are going to the trouble of asking in October 21, 2016, for a FISA order targeted on a person who you know is going to talk a lot with the campaign officials. You better really cross every T and dot every I. And I don't know of any reason not to. I don't. I mean, I've not heard anybody make them articulate any good reason.
We've got Thanks, David.
Less than 10 minutes. Still three questions pending, so let's see if we can get through as many as possible.
Shoot.
Go right ahead, Colin.
Hello, David. What are the chances that Dana Bente will be confirmed as the FBI general counsel, and what are the chances that he remains as acting AAG of the National Security Division?
I really have no idea, and unlike some other folks, I don't want to impugn anybody's character without having a damn good bit of evidence. So I've no idea if he is in any way involved in anything. Now, if you're asking me as a practical judgment, and I'm not a political pundit, whether or not there might be some kind of a hold on a lot of nominations, confirmations that heretofore has been slow walked by the Democrats. If Republicans start slow walking people, it's possible. But I mean, this is unfortunate in my opinion, because God knows one of the huge problems for this administration has been the pace of judicial confirmations has been quite high, and thank God for that. But the pace of folks to fill Article II positions has been appalling, the worst I think in decades, and how the hell can administration function than senior national security officials and not confirm? But as to your other aspect of your question, I absolutely have no idea.
Would the Bureau even want him to testify though in open committee and at a confirmation hearing?
Well, that's a fair point. Again, a very practical and pragmatic point. God knows confirmation hearings have been known to be used for trying to get out of information that otherwise the agency does not want to, or department does not want to disclose. It's a mess. It is a mess. Not the worst possible thing in the world, but yeah, it's challenging. It's challenging.
Just a few minutes left now, and it looks like three questions pending, so let's continue to work through these. Go right ahead, caller.
Thank you for a really good presentation. I, like Kurt Levy, I came in a little bit late, so forgive me if you've already covered this. But if you were to look at what's in the memo that was released as, let's call it a movie, abuse of position, of official position, isn't that already the sequel to the whole previous one where they let Clinton off the hook on the emails? And what I wonder is, what's is the conduct described in the memo more aggravated because of the first edition, that is the abuse of official position with respect to the Clinton email investigation?
Well, look, I understand the question. Let me just say, and I'll choose my words carefully here, because I want to focus on what we do know for sure, which is what in this memo. Your point is that it may well have been a part of a broader conspiracy, if you will, Senator Johnson, if I'm not mistaken, used the word cabal. I was much pilloried for this, but let's use the term provisionally, by a cabal of folks within the FBI and DOJ who first somehow squelched investigation into the Clinton Foundation. And there are certainly stories that a number of FBI agents felt that this investigation was being stymied and were not being allowed to proceed. And then did the same thing, investigation to Hillary's server. And what happened then is that they were trying to ensure that Trump would lose and Hillary Clinton were to win, not necessarily because of some ideological fealty, but just in the theory that their misdeeds would not come out, their misdeeds directed to help Hillary Clinton would not come out quite with as much gusto, as much vigor if she were the president. I've heard those allegations. They're not implausible, but I mean, you know, I don't want to sort of go out and start saying this is what has happened or appears to what has happened, because these are, at this point in time, not, put it this way, the broader theory is nowhere close to being well substantiated as the problem with the FISC application for a surveillance order on Carter Page. So that's why I'm kind of emphasizing this. But again, I mean, there are lots of stories out there about how one misdeed, one corrupt act begets another, and how it's all tied up. Let me just finish this question by saying I do wonder why this misconduct occurred, because, as I said, the allegation that they just had a bunch of people there who were naturally hostile to Donald J. Trump is just kind of hard to credit. So the notion that they did it for some other antecedent reasons is certainly not implausible. But we don't know that. We don't know it for sure, or even close to being for sure.
Thank you.
Still have a few questions pending. We'll get to as many of you as possible. Go right ahead, caller.
Hi, David. I was hoping you could poke holes in this analogy. Generally, people think of prosecutors going to the FISC court to get warrants having to do with terrorism. Would an observant Jew or Christian that did the investigation have to have his religious affiliations and commitment revealed to the FISC court by prosecutors or investigators looking to obtain a warrant against a, say, Muslim suspect?
Well, I would say certainly any government action cannot be tainted by constitutionally prescribed animus. The point number one. Point number two, to the extent that you're going after a person because of his or her First Amendment protected activities, the statute language itself requires you to assure FISC that is not the case. So, but I'm a little confused. Is there some notion that Carter Page was targeted because of his religion?
No, like I said, this was an analogy rather than anything having to do with this case. I think the complaint is generally that, you know, there was a partisan affiliation with some of the folks that provided evidence that was used to obtain the FISC warrants. And I'm wondering if there's a difference between partisanship and religiosity.
Well, there is. I mean, look, I know you can have a long conversation about, look, everything the government does should be driven by fairness and due process and no bias of any kind. But obviously, we all lawyers know that there is a difference between certain types of biases that deal with so-called protected classes or protected categories, talking about race, gender, ethnicity, less national origin, and things that typically trigger strict scrutiny, or, you know, things like sexual orientation that, who knows these days, maybe it's strict scrutiny, used to be intermediate scrutiny. The political biases certainly have not and not quite in the same basket. But I mean, it doesn't mean they're cricket, as you know, probably in the 1983 context, which is a part of a 1964 or 65 Civil Rights Act. Not 1865 Civil Rights Act, post-Civil War. You can bring a cause of action, a lawsuit against state officials, and actually litigate in the space, alleging that they were targeting you because, for ideological reasons, in effect, therefore discriminating based on the content of your speech. So you can, you know, if you jump for all the hoops about abstention and immunities and various other issues, you can get yourself a handsome recovery. But anyway, it's probably too much information.
Thanks. I just wanted to point out that we have to be careful about how broad, how wide the net we cast is when we complain about prosecutorial bias.
Yes, I understand. Not all biases are created the same, but this is a very dangerous. This is a very, again, we're not talking about a Title III warrant against somebody who burgled an apartment. And, you know, the prosecutorial bias may be I'm just so tired of all the damn, you know, criminals I have to deal with, you know, to hell with due process. It's troubling enough. We're talking about something that touches upon, you know, the elections that are at the very heart of our democracy.
Well, Mr. Rifkin, we are out of time. We still have a couple questions pending. That probably argues in favor of another call when we have another big development in this matter. So I certainly appreciate and I want to thank you on behalf of the Federalist Society and our members, you joining us, especially on such a short notice for this sort of breaking news teleform conference call. So thank you so much. This has been very elucidating. Also, thanks to the audience for dialing in and for your thoughtful questions. Reminder to check our website and the monitor your emails for the schedule of the next upcoming teleform conference call. But until that next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this practice group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.